This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. I, Morgan Reynolds, am substituting this week for Jim Fetzer, who tells me he's off on a cruise with his wife. Bon voyage, Jim. I've never been on a cruise myself and don't have much desire to go on one. Better Jim than me. I hope he enjoys. Well, it's an honor and a privilege to fill in for Jim this afternoon and then the next two afternoons as well. I think I've got an exciting lineup of guests, beginning with retired pilot John Lear this afternoon, followed by Jeff Hill of 9/11 Cold Call fame and PumpItOut.com. That'll be tomorrow afternoon. And then on Thursday, I interview Mark Thornton, a Ph.D. economist and senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Mark is also a supporter of Ron Paul, and we will talk about the economy and the Federal Reserve and roam all over the economic landscape, the recent past, today, and the near-term future. So I think we've got some exciting shows. Provocative, maybe even educational. Of course, some may call them irritating, disturbing, or worse, so we will see, won't we? What was it Ricky Nelson sang in the Garden Party? You can't please everybody, so you got to please yourself. John Lear, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Let me give listeners an idea of who John Lear is. He's got a fascinating bio. John, age 65, is a retired airline captain and former CIA pilot with over 19,000 hours of flight time, over 10,000 hours in command of three or four engine transports. He's flown over 100 different types of aircraft in 60 different countries around the world. He retired in 2001 after 42 years of flying. John is the son of the famous Learjet inventor, Bill Lear. John holds more FAA airman certificates than any other airman in the world. These include the airline transport pilot certificate with 23 type ratings, flight instructor, flight engineer, navigator, ground instructor, etc. John flew secret missions for the CIA in Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa between 1967 and 1983. During the last 17 years of his career, John worked for several passenger and cargo airlines as captain, check airman, and instructor. He was certificated by the FAA as a North Atlantic check airman. He held 17 world records, including speed around the world in a Learjet Model 24 set in 1966. And he was presented the PATCO, the Air Controllers Association Award for Outstanding Airmanship in 1968. He is a senior vice commander of the China Post 1 American Legion's Post for Soldiers of Fortune, 24-year member of the Special Operations Association. He has four daughters, three grandchildren, lives with his wife of 37 years, Las Vegas businesswoman Marilee Lear in Las Vegas, Nevada. John, welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Hey, thanks, Morgan.
It's great to have you on the show, and I recall one email where you were discussing speed of the near sea level of a Boeing 767 and remarking about the control problem at extraordinary speeds, and you said, hey, and I can really fly. And with these credentials, who would challenge that, huh?
Yeah, I was just talking with, as a matter of fact, you mentioned the 17 world speed records. The guy that was captain on that flight, I was co-pilot, was Hank Beard, and I think he's listening right now. He was former chief pilot of Learjet Corporation, and he was a test pilot with Republic Aviation. and we were talking about the impossibility of Boeing 767 at that altitude hitting a 208-foot wide at 587 miles an hour. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It cannot happen. It would not happen. And at the height of my career, you know, I can't fly like that anymore, but at the height of my career, I'm sure I couldn't have done it, you know, as current as I was. It's just it's just impossible. It's ridiculous to think that anybody could do it, because you're going too fast, it's too low, it's too difficult to pick out check marks.
Yeah, let's get into that detail in a little bit. I want to spend a couple more minutes on your bio and your dad. Tell us a little bit about Bill Lehrer. Now, everybody's heard of him for the Learjet. And then you mentioned he also was an inventor of the 8-track stereo.
Yeah, you know, he started his career in the 30s. He and Paul Galvin started Motorola, and my dad holds the the patent for the B battery eliminator. And what the B battery eliminator was, they used to have radios in cars, but you couldn't play them when the ignition was on because of the static. So what my dad invented, so they'd have to turn off the ignition in order to hear the radio. And what he did was he invented the B battery eliminator. He was in business with Paul Galvin. They did start Motorola. My dad wanted to go on his own way, and so he sold his half of Motorola to Paul Galvin. Motorola, as you know, is a huge corporation today.
Right.
My dad went on to build or to form Lear Incorporated, and he was busy all during the World War II building all kinds of things for them. And and then in 1956, Lear Incorporated was a large, big company. He modified a Lockheed Lodestar, which became the Learstar, and they sold 60 of those. And then he wanted, in about 1958, he wanted to build a small executive jet. Now, he wasn't the first guy to think of that, because they already had a French jet, the Morane Saulnier. They already had the Jetstar, which is Lockheed jet. They already had the Sabreliner. But he wanted to make a real small one with lots of power for the average civilian. And his company, Lear Incorporated,
the high-rise style corporate jet, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But his board of directors didn't want to go along with it, so they said they weren't going to do it, and he said, okay, well, I'll see you later. And he sold his stock in Lear Incorporated to Siegler. It became Lear Siegler, and then he formed Learjet Corporation and built the Learjet. Now, while he was building the Learjet, that's when he designed and built the 8-track stereo, which became common in all the Ford cars and GM cars of those days. And prior to that, all they had was the 4-track made by Mad Munts, and Dad was the one that was able to put 8 tracks on the same quarter-inch tape and put it in a Mobis loop and make it go.
He's
so
quite an inventive guy, huh?
Yeah, he was a genius, all right.
And an entrepreneur. That I love that line of thinking, since I have so little of that myself. Well, we'll pick this up on the other side of the break, John. And we're back, Morgan Reynolds, talking with John Lehrer, the famous now retired airline pilot and captain. And a couple more things, John, about your background. Let me get your comment on your dad. Was he an 80, 90 hour a week type workaholic, or was he a big family man, or what was his personality like?
No, he was a workaholic. He worked 7 days a week. He worked on Sunday, and he wasn't much of a family man. He used to be around once in a while, but you know, he was more involved in all of his work.
Okay. Well, the other thing that is, of course, I can't resist asking is about what you can tell us about your experience. Quite a few years flying for the CIA and on secret missions around the world.
Well, of course, I flew for contract companies who had contracts with the CIA. I started out flying for World Aviation Service in Florida, and during the Vietnam War in 1966, the Air Force was short of forward air control airplanes, so they bought a bunch of Cessna 337s from Cessna, and I was part of a group that worked under the 4440th Air Delivery Group out of Langley, Virginia, taking those airplanes. There was 350 of them, flying them all the way from Wichita to Nha Trang, Vietnam. And the reason we flew them is, you know, there was no boats to put them on and no other way to get them over there. So they had to be flown individually, and it took 4 years. After that... I went to...
They've got extra fuel tanks, and you go island hopping?
Yeah, we had two 90-gallon fuel tanks behind the pilot seat, a 60-gallon fuel tank where the co-pilot seat would have been, and 20-quart oil that we could pump. And we would make, we'd fly from Hamilton to Hickam, which is Honolulu, and that average flight time was 19 hours. It was single pilot, no autopilot. All they'd do is they'd give us a box lunch, a pill pack, and
and an easy leaker.
Yeah. And then we'd spend a day in Honolulu and recovering, and then we'd go to Midway, and then to Wake, and then to Guam, Anderson Air Force Base there, and then Clark Air Force Base. In the Philippines, and then one short hop, I think it was 5 hours, into Nha Trang, Vietnam. And what we do is we'd detank the airplanes. We'd take some of the equipment back with us, like the HF radio, the life rafts, the oil pump and fuel pumps, and we'd put them all in great big bags. And we'd hitch a ride down to Saigon, and we would have to stay there for 3 days under house arrest, because even though we were given military rank and orders, we came into Nha Trang, which was not a port of entry. So in order to get out of Saigon, an out stamp, you had to pay a fine, and you had to stay under 3 days of house arrest. So after we finished that, we would come back to Wichita, pick up another airplane,
so this,
and do
this
it again.
Doesn't sound like a James Bond-type experience with the CIA.
No, I was strictly a pilot. After that, I went up into Laos. I flew there when the CIA was supporting General Vang Pao, and they had two airlines over there helping them, Air America and Continental Air Services, and I worked for Continental Air Services. And
Now, these were, in a sense, CIA fronts? And,
Air America was a wholly owned subsidiary of Air America, and... Continental Air Services was a wholly owned subsidiary of Continental Airlines under contract to the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the 21st century here, because you've got a lot of interesting things to say about 9/11. That's the big thing I want to cover with you. Let's start by... Well, first of all, I think most of the listeners, if not to a person, knows that 9/11 was a ruse, a scam, and a hoax. It wasn't an inside job. Now, it's your expertise as a pilot that is of immense use here. Let's go to the Pentagon first, where, of course, the official conspiracy theory is that American Airlines Flight 77 went into the Pentagon there at about the first and second floor, didn't muss the lawn. What is your take on that issue? The Pentagon, of course, was the first of the four claimed airliner crashes that where Thierry Masson, in particular, the French writer, said, "Hey, this is a hoax. This is," and he put out two books, as I recall, pretty early. So that one's been in the limelight for quite a while as a suspect, shall we say, to put it as mildly as I can. So what is your assessment about what hit the Pentagon, and or at least why is the official story impossible?
Well, first of all, I'm an expert on the flight data recorder. being a pilot and having read those things before, I know exactly what they say. The flight data recorder, digital flight data recorder, records 156 parameters, and it records each parameter 8 times a second. So I can call that on the internet like anybody else can, and I can read down through there and find out what's going on. And of course, when I first heard about this Pentagon thing, first of all, there wasn't a hole big enough in there, and second of all, the story didn't make any sense of a hijacker making a turn. First of all, he allegedly came over the Pentagon and turned to the right. Well, if he's sitting in the left seat, he can't see the Pentagon. And to make such an accurate approach in 330 degrees a turn is just ridiculous. I couldn't do it. He certainly couldn't do it. And to arrive over
so,
the right...
So is this 300... I've seen this either 270 or 330 degree turn. That means, in a sense, parallel with the Earth. In other words, you've done almost a full circle to come back to hit
yeah.
the Pentagon?
Yeah. Yeah, he 360 is a total... Total circle. He did about 300 degrees, but
mm-hmm.
the thing is, he's doing it in a descent, and he started the descent at 7,000 feet, and he ended up at supposedly 5 feet above the ground at 500 miles an hour. It didn't happen. It couldn't happen. As a matter of fact, CIT Craig Ranke has done some really good work and proven that there was an overflight. And there was two other airplanes to confuse the public. But in the...
They admitted that one guy, O'Brien, I believe, in the C-130, he supposedly was at near Shanksville as well as the D.C. thing.
Yeah.
There were some aircraft or air vehicles in the air.
Yeah, there's two others. But anyway, the FBI went to the NTSB and allegedly recovered these flight recorders, the digital flight data, and then put it out to the public. Well, I've never seen any
evidence of that.
We immediately took the flight data, which is on the internet, and the first thing I found out is in the descent at 18,000 feet, normally, now this is all allegedly when the pilot will already have, this is when the hijacker had already had control, and the first thing through 18,000 feet...
Well, the Beatles are going to cut us short here, and we will be back after this break. And this is Morgan Reynolds. We're back with the pilot, John Lear, getting his insights into... 9/11, what was fake and what might have been real. And John, you were remarking about the flight data recorder data and analyzing that, and you used the word we. I was curious, are you a member of Pilots for 9/11truth.org?
Yes.
Okay. And do you have some colleagues there that were involved in this analysis?
Yes, I talked to a lot of guys there. I was one of the guys that found out the original screw up on the Flight 77 data recorder. And by the way, anybody who's interested in the stuff I'm saying, and if they want to get the flight data recorder stuff, they can either go to AboveTopSecret.com. Or Pilots for Truth. Morgan, I just wanted to say that the thing I came up with is in the descent in the continental United States, airplanes switch from a standard 2992 to the field barometric. And so in the descent of Flight 77, when Hani Hanjour is supposedly flying alone at 18,000 feet, and I mean exactly at 18,000 feet, both the pilot's altimeter and the co-pilot's altimeter are set to field barometric. Now, if he's a hijacker, first of all, how would he even know to set that? And second of all, why would he set the co-pilot's altimeter? And third of all, how did he get the field barometric for Ronald Reagan Airport? He was 150 miles away. He couldn't have possibly received it.
Explain to me and listeners what the field barometric is.
That's the altimeter setting that you set your altimeter to so that when you land at the field, it's exactly the same altimeter. Your altimeter is exactly the same field or same...
mm-hmm.
level as the field, and the reason
therefore your altimeter is reading correctly.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So when the FBI took the flight data recorder from the NTSB, of course the FBI has no idea what a flight data recorder does, and so when they released it to the public, they didn't know that they were releasing the proof that the airplane overflew the Pentagon, because unbeknownst to the FBI, the flight data recorder records the altitude above the ground at standard barometric 2992. It doesn't record the exact altitude above the ground, so that the last recording before it hit the Pentagon is 173 feet. Well, if you correct that for field barometric, and it was 3021 at Ronald Reagan International, and we know that it's 1,000 feet for every millibar, for every 1,000, you have to add 290 feet. So you add 290 feet to 173, and if that flight data recorder was in Flight 77, it overflew the Pentagon by 460 feet. So,
this is bad perping, bad false fabricated data. But now, there are two possibilities. One is that these data from this FDR are entirely fake, or
right.
it is real data from a plane that overflew the Pentagon.
That's correct, and they just stopped it short. They just stopped the flight directors or the flight data recorders short when the airplane would have just flown over the Pentagon. And in fact, it's my opinion that it flew over. And Craig Ranke of CIT is putting out a videotape on that in February.
Oh, good, good.
So that should prove that part of it.
Yeah. So, but can you render an educated opinion on whether it was one or the other? You suspect that it was an actual flyover, and they stopped the FDR recording at some point. They it approximated a stopping at the Pentagon, right?
I think that Chick Burlingame was flying the airplane. I think that he survived. I think he's alive now. And I think that his daughter, Wendy, was murdered a few months ago because she probably found out something, or he was communicating with her. Because all the guys that are in on this, there's a bunch of them still alive, and they're underground. They're undercover, and we're not supposed to know they're alive. But I'm betting my money that Chick Burlingame is still alive.
Yeah, that is, speaking of James Bond, some breathtaking a commentary there. You don't want to be, an assassin who completes the job, and then, hey, you're next, right?
Exactly.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that when his daughter, Wendy, got murdered in the apartment here about two or three months ago in New York, I think that somehow, and it was a very strange murder. It wasn't, I forget exactly what the circumstances, but you can certainly Google it and find out the circumstances. But when I read that, I said, there's no doubt in my mind that Chick is still alive.
Yeah, it would certainly be evidence toward that thesis. Speaking of kind of strange deaths, you recall, maybe it was 6 months ago, this chopper pilot for one of the news channels in New York City, he supposedly was the pilot in which one of these videos, 9/11, was taped, was the victim of a car accident in which he and his wife or family members came out of a theater or restaurant, and a car jumped the curb and killed him. You have any comment about that?
I missed that.
That was
one.
Another one of these strange, after 9/11 type deaths. Might have been an accident.
If it's anything like the Kennedy assassination, there should be about 270 of us dying.
Right. And they came in waves. Every time one of these investigations or some kind of court proceeding was imminent, there were dozens suddenly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's get your take then if we go to Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Okay, Shanksville.
Supposedly where Flight 93 went down, and that was the flight that had so few aboard. They claimed 44 aboard and maybe, I can't remember, a crew of six.
Yeah, that's the one that landed in Cleveland and deplaned the passengers into the NASA hangar there. And
so, do you think, we did get those early news reports. What else do we have to verify that idea?
The fact that all those news reports have been excised from the Internet. I mean, if you have to go really far back to find those. As a matter of fact, they've even changed the actual news stories so that it says Delta 623 or something like that. It's amazing the rewriting of history they've done, you know. And if we'd have known as much now as we did then, you know, we would have been able to retrieve some of this information.
Mm-hmm.
But they've done so
archive
much changing.
Mm-hmm.
Archive it. But
it reminds me of the Soviet revisionism, right?
Absolutely.
Where the history would change depending on the current politics.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Morgan, my opinion is that 93 was supposed to hit the building number 7, and for some reason they couldn't fake it. Now, I'm not going to get into how I think they did it, because people just won't believe it. But let me tell you something. 93 was the one that was supposed to hit Building 7, and when it didn't, they dilly-dallied around for another 5 or 6 hours before they finally controlled-demoed it. And that's why it was so obvious controlled-demoed, because they didn't have an airplane to fake to fly into it.
But what amazes me, though, John, is... You're arguing, now this jumps ahead of the story a little bit, we're on the cusp of some more exciting analysis by our guest, retired pilot John Lear, a guy who can really fly. And we'll be back after this break. And we're back! Morgan Reynolds talking with pilot John Lear about what didn't happen on 9/11 with airplanes and what might have. And John, this business about Flight 93, one of the interesting features is that both alleged United flights, that includes the other one, 175, that supposedly went into the South Tower, we're in the Bureau of Transportation Statistics database, you know, the automated system that records takeoff and landing and arrival and whatnot.
Yes.
Whereas both American Airlines flights were not in that database. So is it your opinion that both United flights were real somehow?
Were what?
Were real. In other words, the United planes, the flights 175 and 11 actually took off.
Yeah, I think they took
not
off.
Not 11. I mean 175 and 93.
175 and 93. Yeah, I think they took off, but I don't think the other ones did.
Okay. Yeah, the two Americans are really fictitious. That's 11, which went in allegedly to the North Tower, and then the Flight 77 to the Pentagon. So let's go back to Flight 93, where the government and media tell us this Boeing 757 tail number so-and-so that they didn't deregister for 5 years went into this little bitty hole with no visible plane debris. That one we can dispense with.
Yeah. Now, this site that I'm telling you that you can find out a lot of, see a lot of these posts, it's called AboveTopSecret.com. Now, when you go on there, don't get mad at these guys, because there's a lot of dumb people on these 9/11 threads, specifically the 93 thread, where there's people arguing that an airplane crashed there. I mean, it's impossible. Absolutely impossible.
Right.
There's nothing. I mean, these people, you know, they're arguing. I don't know what they're bartenders or what they do for a living, but I flew for 42 years. I investigated accidents. I built airplanes. I flew airplanes. I know what's left after a crash. I don't care how fast you're going. There's going to be something left more than what was allegedly in that hole.
You
not
know,
to mention...
One of the things they say, John, absolutely, you know, one of these planes has about 3 million parts, according to Boeing, and supposedly that flight took off with some 10,000 gallons of jet fuel, and it would have had thousands of gallons of jet fuel. It would have lit up big time the minute it hit the ground. You can see that, the instant it hit the ground, and there would be burnt grass all over the place. There's no burnt grass.
There's no burnt grass. The EPA took 5,000 1-cubic-foot samples, didn't find any gas. And you got to go to this ATS.com. These guys are saying, well, it all evaporated and blew away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy what people think. They just don't know. But, you know, if I could just take these people by the hand and lead them down the production line at Boeing, of either a Boeing 767 or a Boeing 757, and say, okay, now I want to show you something. I want to show you the wing box. I want to show you the vertical stabilizer where it attaches to the horizontal stabilizer. I want to show you the spars that hold that stabilizer up.
Mm-hmm.
I want to show you the wing plank. I want to show you these 6-ton engines. And just you tell me how that disappears in the ground. And the latest thing they have is it was a reclaimed mine with soft dirt. I said, look, not only am I a mining engineer, I'm certified as a mine safety and health instructor. Federal instructor. I know about reclamation, and I know how they do it. There's no such thing as that soft dirt. So don't give me that stuff about airplane crashing in there.
It's a dirt. Sometimes, in a way, they serve a function of testing your ideas, but a majority of them, I'd say a heavy majority, and any of these controversial issues about 9/11, are just dig in their heads. They're trolls. They're disruptors.
Yeah.
Some of them, of course, are on the payroll of the perps. You know, they're key pounders at NSA or wherever. And the general public supposedly would be horrified to hear these ideas, but the general public is a lot more open. They're hungry for the truth, I would claim.
Yeah.
Whereas most of this intense, stupid resistance is within the 9/11 half-truth movement, as you're describing it on these forums, because most of the arguments on the other side are just so easily swept aside and countered.
Yeah, well, on 93, you know, there's 250,000 pounds of airplane there, and they only found four pieces, the flight recorder, the voice recorder, a 7-foot fuselage piece of section, and an alleged turbine disc. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
If an airplane goes straight in, which Shanksfield didn't, it went in at 41 degrees upside down. But let's say it did go straight in. The last thing, the last part of the airplane to get to the scene of the accident is the tail. And the tail is the strongest part. That's why they put the flight data recorder and the flight voice recorder in there. But since it's slowed down because of what they call telescoping, it's not going to make it in the ground. So there's always part of the vertical stabilizer and the horizontal stabilizer lying somewhere around. And in this case, there was nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Right. These tail sections are almost like a sturdy, separate thing, and you just see them break off even on a real hard landing.
Yeah.
But like you say, I'm impressed with the structural integrity of the tail section.
Absolutely.
And on the 767 in particular, the height, aside from the landing gear, in other words, in flight, it's like a 49 feet.
Yeah.
And one of the problems is that the gashes in the towers don't allow for any opening or marks that showed where the tail section hit, and yet we can't find it.
Yeah, I took that 170 flight 175, and the real close-up of the South Tower that shows the girl standing there, I'd paint-shopped.
That's in the North Tower, actually, the allegedly Edna Centron appearing in this gash in the North Tower.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah.
I put the 767 in there and drew it exactly the way it was supposed to go in there. And the tail couldn't have possibly gone in there. There's no room for it, you know. It didn't make a hole.
Yeah.
And not to mention the fact, now on the North Tower, how far was it into the core? Was it 60 feet?
Right.
On the,
it's 60 feet from the wall to the core on the North Tower hit.
Okay, so the airplane, which is 159 feet, so it goes in 60 feet. Now, how much, you know,
99 feet or
still
outside the building.
Now, mm-hmm. if that were real, Morgan, when it hit the core, the jolt to the rest of the airplane would have knocked that tail off, and the tail would have gone, you know, soaring over
Absolutely.
Or soaring to the ground. That's,
you know,
that's
another
the realism.
Aspect of that. Yeah, this tail would have broken off, and if you were banking 25 degrees as this silhouette of passage outline would suggest, and the NIST and other government apologists claim, wouldn't it be likely that, you know, this left wing is lower than the right wing, and it they don't talk about it, but does it necessarily imply it's banking left? And if so, the of course the that wing and engine would hit the wall first, and then the wrecking ball would hit that plane counterclockwise, and it would fling that tail section off.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. It none of that makes any sense, and how people have bought it for so long. You know, I like this to post on AboveTopSecret.com, and it gives me something to do because I'm retired and I don't have a heck of a lot to do anyway. So I spend my time on there patiently trying to explain to people why that couldn't possibly have happened. Why a Boeing 767 could possibly have hit the World Trade Center.
And you're a patriot, John. That's why you're doing it. So we will be back after the break. And we're back. This is Morgan Reynolds, substituting for Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo. And today we're talking with pilot John Lear about what did not happen with airplanes on 9/11 and what might have happened with air vehicles and airplanes and the like. And John, a couple of questions occurred to me regarding Flight 93. And one of them is that the government claims that you hear these struggles in the cabin on Flight 93 via a cockpit voice recorder. Is that possible?
Not in the cabin. The voice recorder has three or four microphones scattered around the cockpit, and they record all the audio that's outbound and inbound on the radios, but that's it. It's mm-hmm. extremely unlikely that it could record. No, I'm going to say impossible to record anything in the cabin.
Okay, and I forgot to mention the thing that impressed me about your career was during the last 15 years of it. As I understand it, you principally or exclusively flew the L-1011 TriStar, the Lockheed plane. Is that right?
The last 15 years, I flew the, 2000, that would take me to 85, the 707, 727, DC-8, and the L-1011. But I flew the L-1011 the most, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And the L-1011 is a plane that is larger than the wide-body 767. Of course, it's not as large as a 747, but it's intermediate between those two. Very, very large. I mean, it's a huge plane.
It's a fantastic airplane. It was my favorite airplane, and it had an automatic flight control system in it that was second to none. That was the first airplane that was certificated to fly, to completely land and roll out without any pilot control. And my father was the one that designed the initial autopilot that went into that, which was the L-102C. And Lear Siegler, of course, my dad designed the original concept of the Autoland, and when Lockheed went to build the L-1011, they went over to Lear Siegler and they said, look, we're going to build this giant airplane and we want it to land at 00. How do we design it so that it will do that. So Lear Siegler was able to work with Lockheed and tell him how to do that to comply with the FAA regulations, and And they were the first ones to do it. And then when McDonnell Douglas designed the DC-10, they built an airplane, and they called up Honeywell or whoever it was and says, hey, come on over and put an autopilot in this. And, of course, they did, but they couldn't meet the requirements for the 00 landing, so they were never 00 landing. But the Lockheed L-1011 and its main chief test pilot, Bill Weaver, and chief production test pilot Rodney Boone are both close friends of mine. Great guys, great airplane.
Now, isn't it a fact then that hijackers, the idea of a hijacker taking over one of these planes that can be remote controlled and landed, isn't that a problem for any hijacker? Is that you cannot manually? They can override this, and that is quite a deterrent to hijacking.
Yes, but I don't believe that story. I don't believe they have any control over. I don't think they anybody can take control of an airplane, for the simple fact that the servos that control the controls have a certain number of pounds where they'll release to the input of the pilot. And it would be just too difficult to put two separate sets of servos on each control, one that would go into effect while the pilot was flying it and one to go into effect if it was taken over remote control. I don't believe it. I don't believe it can be done.
You don't believe that the remote control exists because of this obstacle?
Right.
Oh, okay.
I don't believe it exists.
Okay. Another interesting thing, a couple more things about Flight 93. We've got so much ground to cover here, is the flight data recorder. You believe that that data is there and has some validity, or it's all faked?
Some validity. I've been looking at it for the last couple of days. AboveTopSecret.com, I think I have a thread where I gave out the information on it. It's very lengthy. You have to download it into Excel, and there's four sections to it, and you have to know what you're doing. There's 156 parameters, and then there's eight hits for each parameter every second, and I think it goes down to 48,000. And so I've looked at basically all over it. Somebody made a huge mistake when they made that flight data recorder tape, because they don't use any flaps for takeoff, which is ridiculous. I mean, you use flaps for takeoff, and you retract them when you get in the air. And then the other thing is, when they hit the ground, the engines aren't at full speed. They're barely at idle. One, I think, is the N1's at like 40 or 50, and another is at 70, and then both N2's are low, and it's ridiculous. Why would they be there? And you know, it says 587 miles an hour. It's ridiculous. It couldn't go 587 miles an hour straight down a mine shaft. It's just insane. It can't happen.
Yeah, are you saying at low altitude, a 757 could hit that kind of ground speed at 35,000 feet or something, couldn't it?
Oh, that's absolutely.
It's above cruise, but...
That's absolutely.
Yeah.
But...
Okay,
you know,
now here's another aspect of this, and I still want to try to move on to the World Trade Center itself, but you made a stimulating remark regarding you thought the perps had planned to hit WTC-7 with a real plane, and what seems odd about that is that you and I both agree they didn't hit either tower with a fixed-wing aircraft or an airliner. Right?
No. They didn't intend to hit it with a real airplane. It was supposed to be faked, like World Trade Center 1 and 2. But for some reason, they couldn't fake it. And then they were in a dilemma for the next 6 hours of what to do. And when they finally controlled demolition, they probably said, okay, look, we're going to have to go for it, and we'll just have to bite the bullet and make everybody believe that that the little teeny fire at the top of Building 7 is what brought it down.
Well, floors 7 and 12 somehow weakened the whole structure and brought it down. Yeah, absurd.
It's crazy, Morgan, what people believe. I mean, just crazy.
It is. And you got to wonder, can this nation be saved sometimes when they've dumbed down so many people? NIST has a big problem. You know, they've been they're supposed to be investigating the cause of the destruction of Building 7. And I listened to this teleconference that they had. It was just absurd, where they don't know what they're talking about from start to finish, and they don't even have really a game plan, it seems, and they keep putting off the report. I don't envy their problem, but I sure as hell don't feel sorry for them either.
Yeah, you know, the guys that pulled this off, they did a lot of good planning, but there was a lot of stuff they were short on, and maybe that'll get them in the end.
There were so many moving parts.
Yeah.
And, to make it all come together, there was bound to be some glitches, but, you know, the big backup they have, the big smother all or silence in effect all meant is the mass media. They've got control of the airwaves.
Yeah.
So Silencio covers a lot of sin, and
that
backs them up big time. Okay, well, this business about the Tower 2, the South Tower, well, when we come back, we're going to take you to the World Trade Center and try to find out what did not happen and what did, according to pilot John Lehrer. And we're back. This is Morgan Reynolds substituting for Jim Fesser on the Dynamic Duo. Our guest today is pilot John Lehrer. He's a fascinating guy and has an awful lot of knowledge to bring to bear on some of the events and non-events of 9/11. And, John, we were just going to go here to the discuss the World Trade Center, what might have happened there, what surely didn't. And before we address that, I wanted to ask you about the strength of airplanes. I tend to emphasize their fragility. For example, I point out in my basement here I have a sledgehammer, which is 9.5 pounds. Mostly steel, and you put me up on a 767 and give me 15 minutes to wail on it, I'll make it unflyable. You know, I'll tack flaps, panels, the nose, the cockpit stuff, and I'll put a hurt on it. By contrast, if you put me up in a twin tower, I'm not going to be able to find many ways to hurt it. With 9.5 pounds of steel, so I break a window and ding up some machinery. But
okay, and the columns were what, 14 by 14 and 39 inches on center.
Right, 1 meter,
okay.
39 inches, right.
Okay, now it ain't gonna go through that. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and then John, it's backed by these spandrel belts that are 52 inches high of steel, which abut against the lateral edges of these steel-reinforced concrete floors.
Yeah.
It is just hellacious strong before you even get to the core.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the surface, if you measure the areas covered by steel, that is 37% of these walls.
Yeah.
37% steel, all reinforced. It is just an awesome thing, and people believe that aluminum is going to cut right through these beams and lateral edges of floors.
There's a thread on that on AboveTopSecret.com, and you know, they say, well, the speed gave it the energy to go through that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there is a lot of kinetic energy, but they run into Newton's third law of motion, which is equal and opposite. In other words, the force imposed on the plane is just as much as it imposes on the building.
Yeah.
And the building is way stronger than any aluminum plane.
Yeah.
So, it can ding up the building. Maybe an engine has enough structural integrity and strength. Like a la the Empire State Building, B-25, it actually sent an engine right on through.
Yeah.
To the other side. But it would take a lot of luck. You know, that engine would have to, first of all, it's got to go through a couple of these steel columns. Then it's got to, go through the floor, not not a floor, but rather the gaps between the floors.
Yeah.
And come out, it's got to break through some heavy steel on the other side. But, now, of course, where is that? where is all this debris, right?
That's not there. Just take a look at that CNN tape where it supposedly glides through the building. You know, there's no debris, no nothing.
Right.
And it doesn't even hesitate when it hits the core, right? You can't tell me that.
Yeah, even NIST in its report claims they actually sent me a letter saying that you wouldn't expect immediate deceleration by this plane.
Oh, yeah, right.
Can you believe that? In other words, that's a violation of Newton's first law of motion at a minimum, which is that it would be like no resistance, no force was applied, the law of inertia.
Now, the South Tower, we hit the core at 37 feet in, right?
37 feet before you hit the core.
Okay, so subtract 37
from forward. It's like a first and 10, not much more distance than a first and 10 in football.
Okay, so subtract the 37 from 159 feet. You've still got, what, 130 feet of...
122 feet of airplane.
Wind sticking out. that's hilarious.
Where is it? Yeah. Yeah, you know what? On one forum, you talk about the above top secret where you hold sway, but on some other forum, somebody said America fell for the Roadrunner trick. That's about the size of it, right?
They did, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk a little more about airplane strength. On the one hand, there's a lot of stuff here that is fragile. For example, the top of the wings will say no step or do not walk beyond this area. I've seen that on airliners because it's some tender stuff out there.
Absolutely, leading edges or fiberglass composite material.
But on the other hand, you point out, hey, of course, planes that undercarriage, the main spar hangs, the engines themselves, they've got to be able to, that core is pretty strong stuff, right? I mean, it's aluminum alloy. And there's no doubt.
You said the core is aluminum, the core is, you mean of the building?
No, of the airplane. The airplane's got to have some core strength to it.
That's right. There's a fuselage, the keel, and gives it the crown skin that covers the top. That all forms a fuselage, and then when they put it on the wing box forms the structural integrity of the wing, which attaches to the fuselage. Itself, and then you have the vertical stabilizer, which is the one that sticks up, and those spars that hold that make that together go way down in the fuselage, and then you have the horizontal that attaches to that. There's a lot of huge forgings in that thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you've got 5 and 6 ton engines out on each wing and developing thousands of pounds of thrust, and you got to be able to survive the stresses of flying and weather and so on, right? So
absolutely.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the speed issue here. That's been controversial the last maybe 4 or 5 months, and people have raised the question about the extraordinary speeds claimed for the two aircraft that allegedly hit the Twin Towers. The North Tower was supposedly hit by a plane going approximately 440 miles per hour, at 1,000 feet altitude, roughly.
Yeah.
And the South Tower plane, however, is claimed to have been going some 540 miles an hour, which is way up there at an altitude near sea level, only maybe 800 feet altitude. So it's a fascinating question, and we're going to talk about it on the other side of the break.
When we get back from the break, I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Great. And we're back. This is Morgan Reynolds substituting for Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo, and our guest today is pilot John Lear. And, John, I believe we have a caller here. Michael from Oklahoma wants to ask us a question. Michael?
Hello. It's been very fascinating to listen to you guys
listen to your conversation today. And Morgan, you're doing a great job for your first time out running the show.
Well, hey, maybe I'll be back tomorrow then.
All right. I, for a long time, had sort of put together in my own mind that there was probably a flyover of the Pentagon based on witness testimony and the fact that there was no 767 wreckage found at the site itself.
757, they claim. Yeah. Go ahead.
And what you said, Mr. Lear, earlier about the flight data information, actually, I checked that out about a year ago when the pilots put that out. But anyway, something you said earlier I wanted to ask you about, and that is that it was your belief that the both of the American Airlines planes didn't actually take off that day. And that, in conjunction with your mention that you thought probably Chick Burlingame, who was the listed pilot of 77, probably did that overflight.
Yes.
So I don't quite understand what the how we were fooled with the American Airlines planes, and yet Chick Burlingame was flying something that day. Can you straighten me out on that?
Hey, Michael, thanks for your call. Let's listen to John here.
Well, they did not take off, or there was no Bureau of Statistics that they took off, but they certainly came from somewhere. So I believe on the basis of the stuff, the investigation, the thorough investigation that Craig Ranke has done from CIT, that there was probably a flyover.
Okay, and you believe also that FDR data came from that same plane, maybe?
That I don't know.
Yeah.
It looks like it did. I thought it was done somewhere else, but now that Craig has more or less proven that it was a flyover, they probably took that information and from the flight data recorder, because, you know, here we have the altimeters being perfectly set at 18,000 and a perfect flyover at 470 feet. It all makes sense. It all comes together. All they did at the flight data recorder is they cut it off at 1 second before impact.
And that's an error, small perhaps, but it's still an error, right?
That's
maybe
where
not.
The... That's where flight data recorders usually lose their information, because when it impacts, the last second can't get back to the flight data recorder in time.
Okay.
To get on there.
Is that FDR and CVR, they're running off the standard electrical system on board, right? They don't.
That's
have
correct.
To, yeah.
That's correct.
Well, let's go to this question of speed, which some... there's been controversy regarding whether a Boeing 767 could actually fly near sea level at a speed in the neighborhood of 540 miles an hour. And I haven't been able to get, there's arguments pro and con. Joe Keith, for example, a software engineer designed the shaker system for Boeing, says that it would shake apart at those kinds of speeds. FAA claims there would be enough thrust in these engines to offset the air density, and therefore the much greater drag, which is over three times at sea level that it is at 35,000 feet, and so on and so forth. And is there really a definitive answer on that, John?
I think so. The VMO, which is velocity max operating for the Boeing 767, below 23,000 feet is 360 knots. That doesn't mean it can't fly faster. That means the speed that it's authorized to fly at. Now, of course, when the airplane is certificated, they go out and they fly it a little bit faster to, you know, to be sure that it can make that. What those are called is upset tests, and they fly it maybe 300, maybe 400. and they point it down 10 degrees for 30 seconds, and they have to recover the airplane with aerodynamic controls only. So we may be talking about 400, but let me tell you the two things that we're concerned about in seeing if an airplane could go that fast. One is parasite drag, and the other is parasite horsepower. Parasite drag doubles when the velocity doubles. The parasite horsepower required, or parasite power required, cubes when the
right.
speed is doubled. So
drag increases as the square of velocity, right.
Okay, so now the other thing we're concerned with is we have fan engines. The reason they designed fan engines is they put that great big blade out in front of the engine.
Yeah, those are about 8 feet in diameter, those blades.
The reason they put those on airplanes is for takeoff. They give a tremendous amount of thrust, you know, in a very short span. And when they get to altitude at 35,000 feet and the air is thin, there can be gobs of air going through there, but it's thin, and they can handle that, and it's efficient. But where you run into your problem is that in the ground, below 1,000 feet, or like below 10,000 feet, where the air is so dense, and you're trying to speed up, the airplane, the engine cannot handle that. When it goes past the fan, it starts packing in there, and they do have little doors that relieve some of that packing, but if you're going to go much faster than, say, 380 knots or 400, that engine can't handle it, and what it's going to do is start spitting that air out the front at, you know, at 400 knots.
So
and it's just messing.
It's choking on it.
It's choking on it. But it is not, under any circumstances, going to go over 500. It cannot happen. Those airplanes are not built to do that. It's just, it's insane. It cannot happen. The other thing is we're worried about.
That supports my intuition, surely.
And the other thing is, you know, the airplanes are certificated to 2.5 G's positive and 0 G's negative. So that means that under normal circumstances, they could take a jolt of 2.5 if the airplane weighed 350,000 pounds, it can take 2.5 times that without failing, or at least, you know, bending. So what we're having, you know, and what we're talking about is two airplanes on New York in the early morning when the wind is blowing and the conventions that all pilots know come up from the streets of New York, an airplane going 580 miles an hour, it probably wouldn't last 5 miles, because that convection is going to jolt that airplane, and it's not going to be 2.5 G's. It's going to be like three times that because of the speed. That 2.5 is only good for the 360 knots. So if in fact there was an airplane, which I don't believe there was, it's going to be damaged heavily trying to fly it that fast over those convective currents that are coming up from the streets in New York City.
Yeah, and then these currents are highly variable,
all over the place.
The different reflective rooftops and streets and whatnot, right?
So just imagine you're a hijacker pilot and you're coming in at 580 miles an hour. Now, as you go past 360 knots, of course, you're going to get the clacker. Now, that's an automatic system. It cannot be disabled, and that's a loud thing in the cockpit. It goes... and it goes at a rate that irritates the pilot. I mean, they design that thing psychologically so the pilot will slow down. That's what it's for. It says, hey, you're going too fast. You need to slow down. So here's a hijacker pilot, first time in a 767 going at 580 miles an hour with a clacker, trying to stay straight and hit a 208-foot target. No way.
No way. And... we're going to learn more about that. John has a lot of insights about how, even if these speeds were possible, the control issue of hitting a 200-foot-wide target makes it impossible. So we'll see you on the other side of the break. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, subbing for Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo. And our guest today is pilot John Lear. And we've got a lot to talk about here, John, and not that much time left. I want to pick up on this speed issue. Even if these planes were capable of this speed, which you argue they are not, certainly not 500 miles an hour at 800 feet, how could you control this plane, which would be moving at a speed of nearly 800 feet per second, or nearly two city blocks per second. I calculated the other day that if it came in at the south end of Manhattan over the southern boundary of Battery City Park, it would only be in the air maybe 4-5 seconds at most before it hit the South Tower.
Yeah, well, Morgan, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to rent 2 hours in a Boeing 767, and I'm going to take six candidates, some of these armchair hijackers that can say, oh, yeah, I could hit that tower, and I'm going to put them 16 miles away at 570 miles an hour with a clacker going at 800 feet and just say, show me. And just release the simulator.
Yeah, on a flight simulator, you're going to be able to get some candidates who will agree to do that.
Yeah, we're going to get these armchair guys and say, oh, yeah, I can do that. I did that on a Microsoft simulator, you know. And all I'm going to say is I'm going to pay for it, but if you miss, you know, we're going to be recording everything. We're going to be videotaping your face during this thing, and we're going to be videotaping your miss. And then after that, we want an honest statement, you know.
Right. Yeah, I think this would be great. Yeah, let's you don't even have to put your money.
It'll just put a rest to all this, and we'll also have some current and proficient pilots, you know, to see if they can do it too, which they can't.
Yeah.
And it'll just put this thing to a rest.
I recall, John, you did an interview with an unnamed interviewer from Pilots for 9/11 Truth, and he said that morning of 9/11, there were a couple of experienced airline pilots on a simulator. They tried it six times, and they couldn't hit a tower.
I believe it.
Yeah. Now, here's another issue, though, regarding, let's see, what are the problems with arguing there was no plane that hit either tower? Well, the video fakery thing is the pro-plane side is losing badly, in my estimation, to the no-planers on the video fakery, which is well proven, showing impossible, physically impossible events, like you pointed out with the CNN airplane image, just melds or merges, glides into the tower, and doesn't spring a panel or a flap or a wingtip or anything. It just glides in there. So that's absurd. But there are witnesses that they keep. They're pretty much, you know, talking about the witnesses now. So one of the it's true that for every witness who claims they saw or heard, very few people claim they heard this screaming kamikaze airliner and on either tower. But some claim they saw something. Although they're usually, I would claim, are outnumbered. I can find 10. We actually did a study of the FDNY testimony from 501 witnesses, and you only end up with two who claimed, oh, yeah, I saw a plane go in, you know, that were at the WTC or nearby.
Yeah.
It's really very small numbers. But nonetheless, we do have credible witnesses. And so the question arises, well, was there some kind of airplane imagery or what is the magic show? How did, you know, David Copperfield and the perps, well, I'm not accusing him really, but how is this illusion done? So the first question would be, was there some kind of a plane image that some people saw, do you think?
Absolutely, positively, without a doubt.
Now, that's very fascinating. Now, some people say, oh, that's the hologram idea, the holographic projector, or some kind of a skunk works thing, some kind of a light show. But we do know, what's fascinating about this is that they have the black technology to make an airplane disappear, you know, give you the illusion, you know, turn it sky blue. Right?
Yes.
And therefore, the fascinating idea arises, well, maybe you could have this reversed, project a big image. So, for example, one idea being entertained is that there's some kind of a small guided something or other drone or, you know, smallish missile that somehow makes this big airplane image appear. So what you say you know somebody, it's either retired or active at Lockheed Skunk Works or
yes.
similar. Tell us about what your friends of this kind of scientific and technical insight say.
So this holograph technology has been available for 20 years. It can project a airplane like a 767 with total light, heat, and sound, absolutely, totally real. And they've explained to me how they've done it. They've explained where they made the experiments, and not only that, I had lunch with a Lockheed, retired Lockheed scientist in Los Altos Hills in San Francisco in August, and he was not involved in the holograph program, but he told me he saw one. He was driving south on Bayshore to work at Sunnyvale when he worked, and there was another guy in the car, and they looked up, and here's a huge 747, like about 300 feet off the ground, cruising south. And they both looked up and they wondered, you know, what is it doing in this area? You know, we're not near San Francisco International or San Jose. And then all this thing that all of a sudden the thing went out like a light bulb. And he said, and the reason he told me this story is I told him, you know, I said, I'm pretty sure that they used holographs at World Trade Center. He says, I wouldn't doubt it. Let me tell you why. And that's why he told me that story. Then I went to the other Lockheed scientist who's retired and I said, tell me what you know. And then he told me how they did it. So I hesitate to say this because people think this is so far out, but they mm-hmm. have no idea how far the military-industrial complex is in technology ahead of where we think they are, and they're at least 20 or 30 years. And it's hard for people to grasp that.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, this is similar. This idea, which might well be true. I just don't know. We'll have to work on that idea further. But
thank you for giving me an opportunity to get it out.
We need to have some active minds working on these ideas, no matter how controversial or quote crazy unquote it would appear to be. It's very much like Dr. Judy Wood. And I've helped her work on the same idea that something exotic had to be used to turn most of the Twin Towers, these massive structures 110 stories high, to dust. Most of it was turned to dust. Now, that's not conventional technology.
No, that's a molecular dissolution. That's the that's some of the weapons they have up in our secret space stations. And there's probably 8 secret space stations going around the Earth at this time, and they just fired one of those things down.
Well, they've weaponized space. It's almost
no doubt about
thing.
It, and it's
and,
been weaponized
for the platform needn't even be space. Poor Dr. Judy Wood has been ridiculed by the likes of Stephen Jones and so many others, but apparently he coined that term, space beans. And, one of the funny things is I get my television service from satellite. I get my radio from satellite. Why can't you have satellites that do other things with beams?
We do. And if you want to know where they are and what they look like, go to thelivingmoon.com. And you can find a whole section on directed energy weapons, how long they've been there, what they look like, the whole thing.
Okay, well, look, as long as we're going to do wild and crazy stuff a la Steve Martin, let me ask you about the moon. Are you convinced that in the Apollo moon landings of the late 1960s, early 70s actually happened?
Yes, they happened, but they were a cover for what was really going on. We were on the moon beginning in 1962. We were on Mars since 1966. We weaponized space completely in 1970. If you'll notice,
were these landings on the moon and Mars, et cetera, were they manned or unmanned?
No, all manned. We have bases on the moon. We're mining the moon right now. We're mining Mars. We've got all kinds of operations up there, but it's been so carefully hidden from the public, they just don't know.
Well, another far-out idea is that once the Muslim war on terror, you know, finding a worthy enemy, dissolves, that the powers that be are going to scare us with
Planet X.
Aliens.
Yeah, aliens and Planet X. It's all baloney. It's baloney.
There's some amazing stuff there, John. Well, we went from the familiar to the unfamiliar, and it certainly gives our audience some material to think about. And you can find John Lear active on AboveTopSecret.com. You can find Morgan Reynolds at NoMoreGames.net. And we hope you keep your thinking cap.
Hi, this is